From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. Today, on the 6th anniversary of the assassination of former Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, we explore the background to her killing. She knew she was a target.
I suspect elements within the Musharraf administration do have conspired to eliminate me.
On this special edition of the program, we talk to the man who headed the United Nations Commission of Inquiry into Mrs. Bhutto's assassination. His new book is a whodunit that blames multiple protagonists.
There were many people that wanted to eliminate her, even though clearly she was close to the people and her loss was a major loss for Pakistan.
Our conversation with UN Assistant Secretary General Geraldo Munoz follows today's summary of the main headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Alice Olstein. A federal judge in New York issued a sweeping ruling Friday in defense of one of the National Security Agency's domestic spying programs, which was revealed to the public this summer by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden. U.S. District Judge William Pauley in Manhattan said the collection and storage of data on nearly every phone call made in the United States is lawful and protects the country from terrorist attacks. The decision contradicts another federal judge's finding earlier this month that the program is Orwellian and likely unconstitutional. The American Civil Liberties Union filed the original lawsuit against what they call a serious invasion of Americans' privacy and said Friday they will appeal the judge's decision. The U.S. Supreme Court is expected to have the final say. A suspected car bomb in downtown Beirut Friday morning took the life of Lebanon's former finance minister and ambassador to the United States, Mohamed Shatta. He was killed on his way to a meeting with the March 14 political party, known for opposing the regime of Bashar al-Assad in neighboring Syria. The blast also killed at least four others and wounded dozens more. It's just the latest in a series of deadly attacks over the last few months as the conflict in Syria has worsened. After years of argument, the way seems to have been cleared for the relocation of a controversial U.S. military facility in Japan. Despite continuing local opposition, the governor of Okinawa has approved a plan to move the airbase to a quieter part of the island. As U.S. correspondent Malcolm Brown reports from Washington, the decision is being welcomed at the Pentagon.
U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel issued a statement welcoming the decision to allow the relocation of the U.S. Marine Corps Futenma Air Base. The move by the governor of Okinawa clears the way for work to start on a landfill project, which will help provide the site for the new base. The Japanese and American governments agreed to the move all the way back in 1996, but progress got bogged down amidst fierce opposition in Okinawa. The U.S. says the resolution of the dispute demonstrates the strength of the alliance with Japan and allows for the relationship to move to the next level, all this playing out against the backdrop of China's growing military strength. The Pentagon says the Okinawa base move is critical to its ongoing rebalancing in the Asia-Pacific, which will see some U.S. Marines move to Guam and Australia.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. During his Christmas vacation in Hawaii, President Obama signed the more than $600 billion military budget approved by Congress last week. But he issued a rare signing statement criticizing the bill's provisions related to the Guantanamo Bay prison. From our Washington bureau, Emily Carpo has more.
The president called the loosening of restrictions on transferring Guantanamo detainees to other countries, quote, a positive step. But he blasted Congress for renewing restrictions on transferring any prisoners to the United States for trial, detention, or medical treatment, even those cleared for release by the military. President Obama said the continued existence of the prison weakens U.S. national security, damages relationships with partner countries, and emboldens violent extremists, and promised to work with the Congress to fully close the facility during his final 2 years in office.
Same-sex couples in Utah gained the right to marry earlier this week after a federal judge ruled the state's ban on gay marriage unconstitutional. But Utah officials, including the Attorney General Sean Reyes, are now petitioning the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn the decision and put a halt on the hundreds of weddings now taking place in the state.
I think the voice of the people was clear. It's my job not to speculate about political or social issues, but legal issues. And my job and our job as a team will be to continue to defend legally the state laws.
A decision is expected next week. And finally, the unemployment benefits of 1.3 million Americans are set to expire tomorrow after Congress failed to reach an agreement to extend the emergency funding in the budget deal struck earlier this month. These benefits only go to the so-called long-term unemployed, those who have been actively searching for work for more than 26 weeks. Democratic senators say they plan to vote on an extension as soon as they return to Washington in early January. But if it fails to pass, over a million more jobless Americans will lose their benefits in the first few months of 2014. And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Alice Olstein reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports. The former Prime Minister of Pakistan, Benazir Bhutto, making what would prove to be her final speech just minutes before her assassination in the city of Rawalpindi on December the 27th, 2007. She was campaigning in the country's election and had returned to Pakistan from self-imposed exile just a few weeks earlier. A close ally of the United States, Benazir Bhutto's violent death was part of a long and sad continuum in Pakistani history. Her own father, the former Prime Minister Ali Bhutto, was hanged after being ousted by the military. Two of her brothers died in mysterious circumstances. So did the military leader General Zia-ul-Haq. He ruled the nation from 1978 until his death in a plane crash 10 years later that has never been explained. The killing of Benazir Bhutto and the investigation into it is described in a new book, Getting Away with Murder, Benazir Bhutto's Assassination and the Politics of Pakistan. Its author, UN Assistant Secretary General Geraldo Munoz, headed the United Nations Commission of Inquiry into Mrs. Bhutto's murder, and he joins me for this special edition of FSN Reports. Mr. Munoz, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Now, we're speaking on the sixth anniversary of Benazir Bhutto's assassination. And as I say, your book is called Getting Away with Murder. And that is really your conclusion, isn't it? That we're never actually going to know who done it.
That's true. I think there were many people that wanted to either dismiss or actually eliminate Benazir Bhutto. Although she was very popular among the poor and the populace of Pakistan, she was, however, despised by sectors of that country. Particularly, I would say, establishment that is constituted by elements of the military, the bureaucracy, some business class, as well as the intelligence services. And clearly, she was hated by the radicals, by the Islamists, by the Taliban, that understood that she was anathema to them because she was a woman in an Islamic country and she had been prime minister twice already. She was Western, educated. She was supposedly an ally of the United States. She wanted to control the military. She wanted to put a new spin, a new attitude in the relationship with India, which has always been a rival to Pakistan. Perhaps we will never know because there were too many people that wanted to kill her. And on the day of the assassination, there are many doubts that we raised and many issues that we uncovered that suggest there were several actors that wanted her eliminated.
Now, when the assassination occurred, Benazir Bhutto was campaigning in the country's elections. And I was lucky enough to be in Pakistan at the time, producing coverage of that election for PBS. And while we were there, we conducted what would prove to be one of Benazir Bhutto's final interviews. And in that conversation, she told the NewsHour's Margaret Warner that she understood that her security could be in danger. Let's take a listen.
Well, I have been taking the risks
and I have been going out in the public. I've been making some sudden unannounced visits, and I have been using the television to reach out and give my message to the people of Pakistan, where there is a threat to one's core interests, national interests. People send their young men and women to give their lives. America sends their young men and women to Afghanistan, where they risk death. No one turns around and says, don't send our boys because somebody may kill you. So when there is a cause that is larger than oneself, one has to take the risks.
So she definitely understood, Mr. Munoz, that she was in danger. And there was this big debate at the time, and I think it swirls today, as to whether she was wise to return to Pakistan when she did so.
Well, there were many people around her, including many friends, who tried to persuade her not to go back. But she felt a duty to return, to seek to reinstate democracy. Let's remember that at the time was the dictator General Musharraf in power. She also was extremely worried about the increase of radicalism of extremists, and she wanted to rein him in. In some, she felt a duty to go back, even though she was very conscious of the threats. Many of the threats had been passed on to her, but she was adamant about having a duty to return to Pakistan, despite the threats. In fact, in the book, I put an anecdote that was told to me by Zal Khalilzad, the former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan and former U.S. ambassador to the U.N. They were, together with his wife, Anne Benazir Bhutto, on a private plane to Colorado a couple of months before she returned to Pakistan. And there was a stewardess serving freshly baked cookies and offered them to Benazir. And she rejected them, saying, no, I'm on a diet. And then she called back the stewardess and said, what the heck, I'm going to be dead in about 2 months anyhow, so I'll have the cookies. I mean, this was a sort of a black humor example, but that, in a sense, related very clearly that she was expecting not only threats, but actual attacks as it occurred. The minute that she stepped off the plane in October of 2007 in Karachi, where a huge bombing attack cost the lives of about 145 people, but she escaped, fortunately, unharmed at that time.
One of the issues that your book brings out very effectively is the extraordinary history of violence in Pakistani politics, violence that has had touched Benazir Bhutto's own family. You describe the hanging of her father, the former prime minister of Pakistan, as her defining moment politically in terms of informing her view that she needed to play a role in politics. But her brothers were killed. Some of those deaths were never explained. I mean, it's almost a Shakespearean tale.
Absolutely, yes. There's a history of impunity, and that precisely made it even more difficult to establish who killed her. And the first prime minister, Liaquat Ali Khan, was assassinated exactly at the same spot, exactly in the same park in Rawalpindi, where 54 years later, Benazir Bhutto would have been killed. And he was killed in 1951 by a supposedly a lone assassin who was captured by the crowd after he shot the prime minister and killed him. And nevertheless, a policeman came once this assassin had been captured and shot him to death. So that up to today, we don't know who was behind. Was he a lone wolf or was he just part of a plot that we will never be able to uncover as Pakistanis feel? So that there is a history of assassinations, of political violence, and practically all of those cases unsolved.
So given the threats that existed against her, given that history suggested that there was going to be a strong possibility that she was going to be on the receiving end of an assassination attempt, one would think that greater efforts would have been made than you discovered were made to protect her.
Let me say first that the principal responsible here was the state, was the government, because the government had the duty to protect her. She was a former prime minister, and as such, she not only deserved, but she was entitled to receive protection. In fact, during the investigation, we discovered a memo that had been sent by the Musharraf government to provincial authorities instructing the provision of VVIP security, top security, for other prime ministers, former prime ministers, who had been allies of Musharraf, but not for Benazir Bhutto, despite the fact that she had been attacked in Karachi with 145 people dead. So she was excluded from that, but also the local police was irresponsible, was not there to provide the security that they told us they had provided. They did a cover-up. They washed the scene of the assassination an hour and a half or so after it occurred, destroying evidence. They did not authorize an autopsy once she arrived at the hospital, which was required by law. There were many responsibles that did not provide her with the security. I would even say that there were people around Benazir Bhutto that were not up to the challenge and that did not provide the efficient security that she deserved.
Well, the other people, of course, who were aware of the threats were some leading members of the U.S. Congress and leading members of the Bush administration. Should they have done more to press the Pakistanis to provide her with the security guarantees that she needed?
That's a very good question. And Benazir Bhutto felt disappointed by the fact that she did not get all the support from the United States that she expected to push Musharraf to provide her with that security. But there were members of Congress that were very sympathetic to her. In fact, Joe Biden, today the Vice President of the United States, was a member of the Senate, head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and he made phone calls, and he tried to help Benazir Bhutto, as well as several other members of Congress, Senate and congressmen. But it was different. A member of Congress does not wield the same power than the White House vis-a-vis another government. And in fact, Benazir Bhutto felt that Vice President Cheney at that time was the only man that would be listened to by Musharraf. And they were not willing to push the envelope.
So talk a little bit about the reception that you and your fellow members of the Commission of Inquiry received when you arrived in Pakistan, because you relate in the book that in essence you were brought in to see the country's interior minister, and he basically presented you with a report and said that basically the Pakistani government had done your work for you.
Yes, that was quite an amazing moment when we arrived. Myself and the two commissioners that accompanied me, the Minister of the Interior had been Benazir Bhutto's security man and a close confidant. And this was the government of Benazir's widower, President Zardari, that had requested this commission of inquiry. And when we arrived to talk to the Minister of the Interior, he handed me a document, a 70-page document that was, he presented it as almost our report. And he said, well, make the changes that you deem adequate, but here it is everything. It's very complete. So I was astonished because basically he was telling me, you don't have to work. Here it is. You know, you don't need to do anything. And I feel in a sense that perhaps they assumed that we would be a very light commission of inquiry, that we would do some bureaucratic, investigation on the surface, and we would not be an independent commission of inquiry that would deeply look into the facts and circumstances of the assassination, which we did. When we began doing that, perhaps we began stepping on some toes, and even though we were welcomed at the beginning, and we were supported, particularly logistically, at the end of the investigation, I didn't feel as welcome as the outset.
But you also found, as you travelled around the country and interviewed material witnesses and other people of interest with regard to the assassination of Benazir Bhutto, that the country's media appeared to be remarkably well briefed on your activities.
Absolutely. I mean, the leaking of information, secret information, was I've been a public person in the past, so I'm used to the risks of information being leaked to the press, but this was a bit too much. When we arrived, we decided to go to Rawalpindi to see the site of the assassination. Since the press was following us everywhere, we said that we would go by helicopter on an afternoon of the day that we had arrived, and instead we went at 5 o'clock in the morning. And we arrived there, and the police had put roadblocks about 2 blocks away, and we felt sort of secure, but we saw a bunch of people in behind those barriers, and the commissioner, the Irish commissioner, who was a former deputy chief of the police, looked at me and he said, "You're looking at that crowd. You know who they are. They're journalists, and they had cameras, they had photo lenses to take pictures from far away. How they had arrived to that information, I don't know." The same thing happened one time when I went to a secret, and I underlined secret, conversation with the head of the army. And next day in the morning, first thing in the morning, it was in all of the newspapers. So the leaking of information was constant and made me wonder about who was behind all this.
I mean, all of which takes us to a discussion of the role of the Pakistani establishment in Benazir Bhutto's assassination and the culpability of the establishment. And perhaps you could start just by explaining what you mean when you write about the establishment with a capital E.
Well, the establishment is a cluster of actors that are very powerful in Pakistan, the powers that be. And that is constituted by high-level bureaucrats, by members of the intelligence services, the military, and some private business actors. They basically disliked Benazir Bhutto because of what she stood for. She not only feared them, but she was convinced that elements of the establishment would want to eliminate her. And in fact, she sent a letter in October, in other words, just a couple of months before she was assassinated in Rawalpindi, to Musharraf, denouncing three individuals in particular: a former ISI chief. The ISI is the interagency service, the intelligence services, the main intelligence service of Pakistan, Hamid Gul. Then the head of another intelligence agency, the Intelligence Bureau, Ijaz Shah, and another individual who was not related to the intelligence services but was a chief minister of Punjab province. So that she specifically distrusted members of the so-called establishment and gave names and repeated that she felt threatened.
And she didn't die silently, in the sense that she had sent an email to Wolf Blitzer of CNN, only to be published in the event of her death, in which she said that if she were killed, she would hold Musharraf responsible for her death, General Musharraf. And if I can go back to that interview that we produced for PBS just a few weeks before her death, she said something very similar to the NewsHour's Margaret Warner. Let's take a listen.
"Yes, I suspect elements within the Musharraf administration do have conspired to eliminate me through a terrorist attack, and I suspect elements within the administration who continue to try to eliminate me."
So she clearly felt that the Pakistani establishment ought to be held responsible in part for her death. You in the book certainly don't rule out the possibility that the Pakistani Taliban, which was blamed by the government for her assassination, had some role to play in it. But you write that the village assassinated her. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, I was thinking hard about the question that many people have asked me. So who killed her? And it is a very difficult question to answer, because I felt that I had to find a metaphor. And the metaphor that I found was a Spanish play, an old Spanish play called Fuente Ovejuna. Fuente Ovejuna was a village in Spain. This ruler of the village was very hated. And one day this hated ruler of the village is assassinated. And the magistrate that arrives to investigate the assassination begins to interrogate the villagers. And every villager says, Fuente Ovejuna did it. In other words, the village did it. No one says anything but the village killed her. In a sense, I feel that Benazir Bhutto was killed by the village. I mean, the Al-Qaeda ordered the assassination. They hated her for the reasons that are well known. The Pakistani Taliban executed it, probably with help from elements of the establishment, with elements of the rogue intelligence agencies or individuals linked to it. The local police made a cover-up, washing the scene, not authorizing the autopsy. Musharraf, in a sense, facilitated it because he did not provide the security that she was entitled to. Then the people around her own security services, failed her. And in the end, those that stimulated her to go back, like the U.S. and the U.K., did not want to assume any role in her security, even though they stimulated her to go back. So in the end, it was, as I said, the village.
Now, she had previously a checkered career in government. She'd served as prime minister, not always without controversy. But is the ultimate tragedy here not just that we'll never know what she might have done had she stayed alive and continued to fight in that election, but also that ultimately Pakistan just doesn't escape that sort of Shakespearean violent cycle, and therefore the United States never escapes the yo-yo of up and down relations between Washington, D.C. and Islamabad?
I think there's a Shakespearean dimension. There's also a parallel with the Kennedy family, many of whom disappeared in untimely deaths. And that relationship with the U.S., it was indeed up and down. They wanted her back, but at the same time, they wanted Musharraf, because Musharraf was a guarantee of the army's commitment to go after the extremists. At least there's some consolation in the sense that her death may have contributed to some stability in Pakistan and to the fact that for the first time ever, a government, that of her widower, Zardari, completed a full term and was able to hand over power to another elected government, that of Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. And that is something that is commendable and has to be underlined, maybe as an inheritance of this sad affair.
Well, it is a fascinating book. It is called Getting Away with Murder, Benazir Bhutto's Assassination and the Politics of Pakistan. It's published in the United States by Norton, and its author is the UN Assistant Secretary General Geraldo Munoz. Mr. Munoz, thank you very much indeed for talking with us today.
Thank you very much.
And that's today's special edition of FSN Reports. Let us know what you think of the programme. Our email address is reports@featurestory.com. On Monday, another book conversation. We talk to political activist and education theorist Bill Ayres, a significant figure in the weather underground during the 1970s. He has a new book, Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident, and some new views on Barack Obama.
I mean, I can't say he's a war criminal, but I can say that there's a case to be made for criminal activity at the top when it comes to questions of human rights abuses and war and peace.
That conversation with Bill Ayres on Monday's edition of FSN Reports. For now, I'm Simon Marks in Washington. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great weekend. Goodbye.